Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio. And welcome to Arian Talk. This is Pat Schnard, and here is Matthew Raphael Johnson, PhD, from University of Nebraska. And we're welcoming him into the show now. Hello, Matthew.
Hi. Is my audio okay?
It's fine.
Oh, great. Wonderful.
So, Matthew, we're going to be talking a little bit. We're going to be picking up where you actually were my host on White American Radio when I was on Talk Shoe, were you not?
You mean guest?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, one time. Yes, it was excellent.
Yes, and we talked about Putin and also the Bolshevik Revolution. So we covered a good swath of history from the early 20th century up to the present. But in this particular show, I'd like to go back, if you don't mind, to Russia during medieval times and the struggles of Russian Aryan peoples at the time, the entrance of the Vikings and their eventual adoption of Orthodox Christianity, and also a little bit about the heathen periods of Russian history right in the beginning in Kiev. Could you cover that? Could you kind of give us an idea of the beginnings of Russia as a nation, as a people?
Well, I don't hold to the theory that the Vikings somehow colonized Western Russia.
In
Russia, it's largely been abandoned. In Ukraine has been abandoned, that theory. Americans have a tendency to be a little slow on that stuff, like the nature of the Mongol control. But the conversion officially is in the very end of the 10th century, where St. Vladimir, tiring of his previous life, converted his retinue. In other words, his armed guards. And in his particular case, he became extremely enthusiastic. He eliminated so much, he was such a bohemian prior to that. He was very strict in his asceticism, which is interesting.
So with that case, I know that he was considering. He sent emissaries to Western Europe, to Rome, and to the Muslims and to the Jews. But because of their dietary laws, he figured that it would be best to go with Christian Orthodoxy. Is this the case?
That's right. His emissaries had heard a mass in Germany. They heard the liturgy at Hagia Sophia in Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this is just after the destruction of the Khazar Empire, so Judaism was pretty much out of the question. But Islam would also have been a strategic choice. And that's right. He chose Orthodoxy for a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of which was the fact that they allowed him to drink outside of Lent. But I want to stress that it came from Bulgaria. The Greeks in Western Rus couldn't speak the language. Most of the books early on were Bulgarian. So that was really it was an indirect connection to Constantinople, is what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you say that the Russians also acquired some certain cultural values or cultural similarities to the Bulgarians and to the Orthodox persons of the Eastern Empire, along with the religious, maybe through interactions with the Bulgarians in the Eastern Byzantine Empire?
Well, many of them married into the Byzantine Empire, making them the heirs to Rome.
Mm-hmm. Which
that would be. And this was a regular occurrence. And one of the biggest cultural things, from our point of view, that they accepted really was increasing centralization of political power. Relative to the time. But that was something that, the Byzantines were strict monarchists, and they treated decentralization as something that would really encourage the oligarchs to rule.
You would say the oligarchs are a long-standing Russian tradition.
Well, yeah, they're everywhere, of course, but they're very obnoxious in Russia. This is what caused Ivan the Fourth or Ivan the Terrible to create his Opichnina. They had their own private armies. They had their own intelligence service. They had their own contacts with Western powers. So it was either going to be crushing them or no Russia.
So let's go back a little bit before this period of Christianization, back to the Viking expeditions into Russia, and even before that, the pagan period of Russia. What do you know about that? What can you tell us about the ancient Aryan heritage of Russia?
Well, most of the traditions prior to Christianity didn't conflict with it. I don't really believe that paganism is religion as such. I think it's a very profound cultural, philosophical, poetic way to understand the world, to personalize the world around you. Mm-hmm. The Zeus was never meant to be believed. I mean, maybe the simple people did, but the elites knew better. And rather, these were archetypes. These were very powerful social and natural forces that were given personalities. And within these stories, which always changed, they encoded a tremendous amount of information about who they are and what they were. A Svarog would be the main Russian one.
Can you tell me a little bit more about some of their traditions as opposed to what we know of the Christian Russia?
Some of their what?
You know, of any of their traditions or anything specifically about the pre-Christian Aryan inhabitants of Russia that might illuminate a little bit of their earlier history or actual prehistory?
Well, part of the problem with this is that they weren't a literate society.
Mm-hmm.
Christianity brought literacy. That was the case in the West and the East. Obviously, Christianity is religion of the book. And so you have the same problem in Ireland. So the traditions here are very foggy and very iffy. There were no secret societies in Kiev like you had in Egypt and elsewhere. I think in the Russian case, what you had is a very simple and very pure approach to the natural world.
So these were more nature worshipers, and the beliefs kind of anthropomorphized those natural tendencies and belief of nature.
So you're breaking up, Patrick. Say that one more time.
So their beliefs were more of the anthropomorphizing of these ancient nature beliefs. This worship of nature was transformed into anthropomorphic manifestations of that nature worship, correct?
Yes, slowly over time.
Okay. So what do we see happening during the Viking expeditions into Russia, and what kind of role did they play, if any?
Well, this is a huge controversy. I was taught and believed up until just a few years ago that prior to St. Vladimir and Christianization, that the Slavs, being unorganized and desperately needing to protect the trade on Dnieper to Constantinople, needed a firm administration with power and teeth behind it. And they called in the Vikings. That's been the tradition in, you know, American historians for a long time. And it's not true. At least I don't think it's true. And they tried to make the claim that Rus and Viking was the same thing. And yet, you know, when Andre, the Prince of Vladimir, part of Muscovy, planned an attack on Kiev, he said he was going against the Rus. This, another evidence, supports the opinion that even in Kievan Rus, the word Rus implied southern Russian lands, namely, you know, Kiev, Cherniv, Pereslav, Volin. Questions then, why would one use the word Rus for Novgorod, where Rurik had taken up power initially? Rurik, of course, being the first Viking or Norman prince to take up authority to protect this trade. So there's a lot of problems with the theory. But the relationship between, like, say, for example, St. Olaf of Norway and Yaroslav the Wise was extremely positive and very good. And so there certainly was interaction. But the language barrier was a problem. The religious barrier was a problem. Now, that's not to say that in Constantinople there wasn't the Varangian Guard. It's right in the name. So these were respected people, but they weren't there sufficiently to create a new culture. The Slavs have been organized and trading with Constantinople and everywhere else hundreds of years prior to that. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a myth, but it shouldn't get in the way of people thinking that there was no interaction. The interaction was very positive.
You know, if the Slavs, the native Slavs, because I've been doing some research on the Slavs, and it turns out that the Slavs and the Eastern Germanics were probably the earliest branch to break off, along with the Hittites, at least the culture that led to the Hittites, were the earliest break off of the Indo-European Aryan family, and those were their immediate descendants. Were the Slavs, the Proto-Slavs, engaged in any megalithic constructions? Do you know of anything like that? Are you familiar with those? Is that not part of your expertise?
I have never come across anything like that at all. What has been uncovered is a fairly advanced commercial culture around the Dnieper River, including northern areas like Novgorod, going back long before Rurik ever took power there. So, but megaliths, no, you don't see it.
But there is evidence that the Slavs had an incredibly advanced culture then, an incredibly advanced Aryan culture.
Absolutely, yes.
Could you maybe tell me a little bit more? Are there any well-known historical references or stories or analogies related to of this trading culture?
Well, one place to go, you have the Britannian Annals, which make reference to a visitor in the Ingelheim court by men of the Kakian Rus. The Chronicle of St. Bertine makes a distinction between Swede and Rus and shows that they were very different. So you see, the main chronicle tradition in old Russia doesn't show any kind of colonization whatsoever. But the traditions I think that we're talking about is, number one, a strict communitarianism, an absolute rejection of individualism in all of its forms. Number two, a very simple devotion, something that Kolmyakov makes reference to. Whatever the force is that they were worshiping is always very simple and always very pure. Number three, the spirit versus the letter of the law. Now, I know they don't have letters at the time, but the concept is still the same. Alexei Kolmyakov made a distinction in his historical work between Aryan and Kushite culture. But this is the big dividing line in the world, or at least the European world. And Russians were, in support of your theory, actually, were the main progenitors of the Aryan idea there. Sometimes in English it gets translated to Iranian to avoid the association, but he meant Aryan.
That's fascinating. That's very, very fascinating. So let's go back. We were talking about the Christianization period. Can you tell me a little bit about the history immediately following the Christianization of the Kievan Rus?
Well, the most important thing to note is that St. Vladimir as a man changed radically. There is little evidence for, you know, people back then followed the religion of their rulers. They followed the religion of those who were the strongest. So to talk about a forcible conversion is anachronistic. Just the concept didn't exist at the time. But when the local lord had converted, everyone did. And it came from Bulgaria. It was a very simple Bulgarian Orthodox traditionalism, essentially, is what it came from. It led to the centralization of the state and to a written law for the first time in Russian history. Those are the big things.
So after that happened, we're going into, say, the 11 to 1200s. What was happening once royalty was solidified, Christian morality and government and reason began to be the standard throughout Russia? What happened after that? Let's start getting into the emergence of the royalty, so forth and so on. Can we get a little more information about that period, and just go all the way up to the present?
To the present?
Yeah, all the way from that time on. Let's hear the whole history. I'm very fascinated by Russian history, and I think our listeners would definitely want to hear about it.
Well, that's a tall order. But let me give you the general. I'll give you the general outline here.
Sure.
Church always was one of the most popular institutions in Russian history. It was the institution that always stood for unity as opposed to oligarchy, the common good as opposed to oligarchy. Patriarch Hermogenes, during the time of troubles. This is, of course, 16th century, refused, he was starved to death by the Poles rather than bless their occupation of the country. This was the institution for legalism, law, and generally speaking, what you had was the family life, family law, and economic law being given over to church control. Everything else was, foreign policy was in the hands of the prince. There was one distinction, and that was Novgorod itself. But outside of it, you had entire court systems run by the church, and they were just as powerful as the state, and they acted as a check on the state until, of course, Peter the Great. Peter the Great is one of these major dividing lines in history. Peter was initiated into the Masonic Lodge in Amsterdam, and he came back to Russia a new man, and he wanted to create a new Russia. He didn't care for the church or the tradition whatsoever. In fact, in St. Petersburg that he created, you couldn't wear Russian dress in the main Nevsky Prospect. You had to wear Scandinavian clothing. But one of the things he did is make sure that he purged any traditionalists from the church, and he personally oversaw the torture and murder of every major bishop in the Russian church from when he took over. Not quite after Tsar Alexis died in 1676, but all the way up until, and he put this in the hands of a man named Feofan Prokopovich from Kiev, who was a Lutheran in his views, but was metropolitan of the chief prelate in all Russia for the Orthodox Church. I think he was an atheist and a materialist, and anybody else was sent to the gallows. In the 18th century, Peter, the rule of the foreign rule of Lord Byron, and then Catherine II, and close out the 18th century, secularized the church entirely. They took their property, all income, the church had to go to the state. So he bought a candle that had to go to the government. And in return, priests and bishops were put on a salary. And this salary was very, very low. One of the people who protested this, one of my favorite saints of all time under Catherine the Great, Matveyevich, was tortured to death by Catherine for opposing this idea. And so the church had been made quiet. Now, there was, of course, the Old Believer movement. I have strong interest in the Old Believers. I have a book out on the Old Believers. I call myself an Old Believer sometimes. The Old Believers refused to follow Peter's reforms, really Nikon's reforms at the time of Tsar Alexis. In 17th century, middle 17th century, the major council that anathematized the old Russian Orthodox tradition was in 1666, which is odd. And as it turns out, the bishops coming from the other Eastern countries were frauds. They weren't who they said they were. It was very difficult to check on people back then. And so, but I largely think it was Peter's violence and Peter's tyranny, that hyper-centralization, that led to the Old Believer movement becoming very, very strict and very large. They numbered about 30 million by 1900. Most say at the time, like the head of the Synod, Sabler, says that every peasant deep down is an Old Believer. They're communalist, they're commercial, but always for the common good, not for personal profit. And the royalist, but not in the sense of ruling. A monarch is an icon. He is an example to follow, not someone to impose laws. Back then, laws weren't considered things that you could just pass and impose on people. Laws were slowly but surely uncovered over time, because they were built into the very nature of humanity. And, of course, the revelation itself. The Old Believers remained very, very strict. And that was the dividing line in Russian history. Solzhenitsyn says the same thing. So you always had two Russias. You had the Old Believer Russia, and you had the Petrine Russia. Tsar Nicholas II tried to bring those two together and failed. There were many attempts to bring them back to the church. They were tortured and killed en masse. They were persecuted in large numbers, but they would never go away. There was too many of them. And my personal opinion is that Peter the Great was the main reason for this, that his violence and his overwhelming force and his foreign masonry and everything else he tried to do drove the after-Russian Persian to hate him and join this movement. So the Old Believers are fascinating. They're the largest church in Russia, by the time of the revolution. Is that good enough?
That was excellent. The funny thing is, we're seeing here, and this is in, and allow me to interpret this, a lot of us in the white nationalist movement tend to believe that Christianity is a cancer, that it's overwhelmingly Judeo in a sense, and actually against the idea of blood and soil and against the folk. But actually, we're seeing in Russia something quite different than the phenomenon we see in Christianity today, at least mainstream Christianity. We see a very strong, blooded soil, folk-related movement that, contrary to how it exists today, was probably very anti-Jewish, but also very pro-Slavic and pro-people. And we see a very strong foundations in the folk in the Christianity in Russia at that time. Do you agree on that?
I absolutely agree on that. If I wouldn't be a Christian today if I hadn't come across the Eastern Orthodox Church. Western Protestant evangelicals are often taken as representatives of Christianity as such. And that's a shame. That's a terrible shame. Because they're a new phenomenon. And they're frauds. And there is no tradition there. There is no connection to anybody, blood, soil, or any other people. It's an individualist commercial establishment, really. But in the East, you have churches named after countries. That should give you the first indication that these are national institutions. And they're very closely, and they're great saints associated with the nationalist tradition. Cosmo Theotolian, during the waning days of the Turkish occupation, connected Russian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox theology with a strict political nationalism and made him one of the most popular saints of Greece. I'll never comprehend why there are those who think that Christianity is Judaic unless they take these Protestants evangelicals as the church, in which case I would understand. But Christ was murdered by the Pharisees. The Pharisees are the progenitors of the today's rabbis. And Judaism exists today to destroy the Christian world. And Christ is anathematized over and over in the Talmud. So I'm not sure how that could even work there. The Old Testament is another matter. These are Israelites. These aren't today's Jews who come from Khazaria or Poland. Try to connect them is ridiculous. There's no connection whatsoever. Your neighbor Fred Goldstein has no genetic or religious connection to Moses. So the theory that Christianity is this terrible thing because Judaic is laughable. Judaism is it exists and functions as an enemy of Christianity. It its entire creed is negative to destroy Christianity. So it just doesn't work that way.
And this is interesting because I once read an article in the Renegade Tribune that was saying that Christianity, you can't be a nationalist if you're a Christian, in the sense that the Christianity talks about, no worship of graven images, no loyalty outside the church. Now, is this really what the Bible said, or is this more or less what evangelical Christians preach, as opposed to, say, what the Eastern Russian Orthodox Church preaches? This idea that, if you're loyal to the state, if you're loyal to your folk, then you're not loyal to Christ. And correct me if I'm wrong, there's even been some rumors that Christ was a Galilean, therefore of Celtic origin. What do you think about both of these comments?
Well, as a Celt myself, that makes me very happy. But we're not saved by our race or ethnic group. That doesn't save us. It might help, but there are too many saints in the history of the Orthodox Church that were tightly connected to the state. Loyalty to an Orthodox government is the highest loyalty outside of the church itself. And the two powers are to work together in symphony. That's really the Orthodox tradition. The word symphony comes up again and again to describe the relationship between the legal order and the state and then the church. It hurt quite a bit when Stalin invented his own church. He called it the Russian Orthodox Church in 1944, releasing four bishops from prison and pretending this was a new synod. And that's actually the Russian Orthodox Church today. It derives from that. Now, they have condemned that. They recognize that, but that's their origins. Most of the church was underground or abroad or dead. But other than, and speaking of which, when Hitler invaded the USSR in 1941, the Orthodox world rejoiced, and not only rejoiced, but called Hitler one of the greatest men of the day. And this was from Metropolitan Anastasi of the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia. And Hitler had a Metropolitan Seraphim Lade, L-A-D-E, who was of German origin, that he made the head of all the Orthodox people in the, however big the Reich became, that was his jurisdiction. And he was never excommunicated or threatened or anything else. He died in good standing. And he was close to the Metropolitan Anastasi of the, who would be his head. In the church in exile, and Hitler saw them as decent people who could help him in his war against Russia, war against the USSR. So there's so much we can go into here, but for nationalists and traditionalists, Orthodoxy is the only place to go.
And let's get into that part where you're talking about Hitler and the relationship between him and the Orthodox Church. This is something that's not usually brought up, which is never brought up, in fact. And I think it's relevant to this discussion since we are, I consider myself a national socialist, and I think that this would be an excellent thing to talk about. Can we talk about that?
We most certainly can. I have on my website, rushjournal.org, several letters to my previous bishop who didn't agree with this kind of thing, that Hitler was seen as, it wasn't just because he was fighting Stalin that he was a good guy. No, it's because he was a harbinger of social justice that he was a good guy. Let me read very briefly from St. Philaret Drozdov. And his condemnation: the state is a union of free moral beings united amongst themselves, the sacrifice, part of their freedom, for the preservation and confirmation by the common forces of the law of morality, which constitutes the necessity of their existence. And civil laws are nothing other than interpretations of this law in application to particular cases and guards placed against its violation. Now, he said that in the anathema against Freemasonry. To love the Tsar separately from Russia or the Orthodox Church was unthinkable up until 1914. Ivan Kadevsky, one of the great Orthodox writers of the 19th century, said, "For Orthodoxy is the soul of Russia, the root of the whole moral existence, the source of her might and strength, the standard of gathering all of her different kinds of feelings into one stronghold, the earnest of all her hopes for the future, treasury of her best memories, object of worship, boundlessly devoted to him because he does not separate the church from the Tsar." And this was the official position. This is how it works. This is how it's always worked. and the war, you know, Serafin Lad and the Department of Anastasia, the Synod abroad, Russian Synod abroad, have been largely covered over by Orthodox people recently, not realizing exactly how profound their love for Hitler was, and what, you know, Hitler would was doing for them.
And you know, this is true.
About Hitler, that he was so overtly racist. Okay, and that he was not only overtly racist, he was, you know, a vicious, as they call him, anti-Semite. His main concern about the Jews was their control on the German people and the Aryan people and what they were doing even back then to instigate white genocide. He didn't hate them simply for the sake of hating him, as he's implied of being. And you often see those pictures of him with the stern face when Jesse Owens wins the gold medal. This, again, it wasn't true because Hitler also has been, he was observed as shaking Jesse Owens' hand. So he was, even in his second book, not apologetic, but open to the idea that other races are on their own standing. And he's most certainly, as you say, felt the same way about the Slavic peoples of Russia, not as his enemy, not as something inferior, but as something to be loved and cherished as fellow Aryans. And I also want to say, too, that any anti-Slavic rhetoric he gave was coming to the fact that, you know, there was a certain rivalries between, you know, Germany and Slavic peoples, and maybe he was capitalizing on this, that for votes, because he was a shrewd politician. But deep in his heart, he had love for the entire Aryan people. And he was, in fact, almost a savior to the Aryan race in the sense that he put forth ideals which are still lasting to this day. What do you think about that?
No, I think that's true. I have a podcast, more than one, actually, in an article on what happened in his occupation of Ukraine, putting the Commissar Koch in charge of Ukraine was an absolute disaster. I believe that's what lost him the war. His treatment of Slavs was so bad. His loathing of Orthodoxy and Slavdom in general was so bad that people started to think that he was working for the Soviets. Well, funny thing was, he wasn't executed at Nuremberg. He died a natural death not too long ago. Somehow, he got away with it. And that, for me, proves that he was that he was working for Stalin. Hitler was surrounded by traitors and frauds. And that's one of his biggest, you know, the biggest problem he ever had, dealing with that. In the Slavic case, you know, when they invaded Ukraine, nothing could be more popular. Nothing could be more popular. They were working together. I have a podcast on the what the Russian Volunteer Army was doing with the German infantry in near Rostov. They created a whole new experimental society based on National Socialism, which back then, you know, wasn't a bad word. You know, so this is you know, this has to be put out with greater force, I think. You know, not just the Russian church, but the Ukrainian church as well.
Do you think that the SS and many of their anti-Slavic rants were acting independently of Hitler?
That was Willis Cardo's opinion. You know, I mean, Eric Koch was SS, and I believe that Hitler was being lied to about him. I think Hitler was being told that everything's okay, where clearly it was not. So I firmly believe that you know, one of those damning quotes you have from the SS is Himmler's speech in 1944, the Posen speech. But I don't think that was Hitler. It doesn't make any sense. That wasn't Hitler's view. You know, it may have been Himmler's view, but that was it. And I believe much of what happened in Ukraine under Koch occurred because they were acting independently of Hitler. Yes.
Hello, folks. Sorry about that. There was a situation where my microphone was not working, which is a good reason why I have to replace it. I'm very, very sorry about the problem, and we will get back to everything pretty soon. I'm now logging in to the site. And hello, Matthew there.
Yes, I'm here. That happens. There's no problem.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry about that, Kyle. What we were talking about was Hitler and Koch. Now, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, do you think that Hitler thought, I mean, this is what the rumors were, and I know that Himmler himself had great racial animosity towards the Slavs, but do you think, and I haven't read the whole second book, have you read the second book about Hitler, his second book at all?
You mean The Table Talk?
No, his second book was a book he wrote that was unpublished and it just came out a number of years ago. My main question is did he in any of his writings indicate a admiration or love or respect for the Slavic peoples directly?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, but Germany and Russia had been longstanding opponents. You know, it was an issue. And it wasn't even Russia in his case. We're talking about the Soviet Union.
So you agree to the fact that it wasn't a racial mission as the Jews and academics say it is, but rather it was, in fact, animosity towards the communist Bolshevik Jewish manipulation of Russia, its control, and possibly an impending invasion of Soviet Union to Europe that prompted Operation Barbarossa.
Exactly, precisely. And I wouldn't have known that had I not read Hitler's War of Extermination by Joachim Hoffmann, and I know Eichrecker is a big one, and he took the fangs out of that viper, and so it was essential. And his main concern with the Jews in Germany and elsewhere was that they were Bolsheviks allied with the USSR.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that which is new. I mean, usually when I'm sorry, I forgot what I was going to say.
That's okay.
We can't talk about Russia. You know, they were equally suppressed along with all the other nations of the Soviet Union. You know, these people, Stalin included, and I have several papers on this. He was no Russian nationalist. He was no Christian. He was nothing. He was no different than Trotsky. And Hitler was aware of this. No.
He wasn't a Jew.
No, absolutely not. There is no – they want to claim that DZU, the first syllable in his name, last name, is Jewish, means Jew, and it's not. There's only one word for Jew in the Georgian language, and that's Ibra'ili. It is a weird last name, though. It is a very weird last name. Very few other people in the country have it. But it's not a Jewish name. He was not a Jew. But at the same time, he surrounded himself with Jews, and he was not an anti-Semite. I have several papers on that, that he was, which is a big claim. You know, it made it okay for the left to hate the USSR for a while under Stalin. So,
that Stalin was supporting and surrounding himself with Jews. So even though he wasn't a Jew himself, he was pro-Jewish through and through. Would that be an overstatement?
That's only a slight overstatement. It's only a slight overstatement. and it needs to be promoted. You know, the idea, Stalin has this reputation of being an anti-Semite because he purged so many members of the party who were old Bolsheviks from that first generation of revolutionaries. Well, they were almost all Jews. So it's very easy to think of that as anti-Semitism. In fact, it wasn't a good concern at all.
So he basically purged them because they weren't loyal to him. They were loyal to the memory of Trotsky and Lenin and their version of Soviet revolution compared to what he wanted for loyalty to him and his state. And that's the only reason he purged it. It wasn't because of any Jewish background. That wasn't a consideration at all. Is that correct?
It was not a consideration at all, no. Stalin believed in international revolution. He was a globalist. He was an internationalist. But the division between he and Trotsky was certainly based on the Jewish issue. There's no question about it.
So what you're saying is that there was a Jewish implication there was a Jewish motivation behind the purging or Stalin's view of revolution itself. Is that correct?
No. What I mean is that Trotsky and Stalin split largely because Trotsky was a Jewish nationalist. Now I have papers published now on Trotsky, essentially rejecting Marxism as he's commanding the Red Army. He had no particular loyalty to Marxism or anything else. A lot of what he said about the state and society were non-Marxist. The only thing I could find is that he was a consistent Jewish nationalist, secular, but a consistent Jewish nationalist. And that's what worried Stalin. It had nothing to do with a particular form of nationalism, but that he was a nationalist that had won nothing to do with communism. Remember, when Trotsky was murdered, he was worth about $1 billion. He had one bank account in New York City, two in Switzerland, showed a ridiculous amount of money in there. These guys were all very wealthy.
Would you say that there's any connection between Trotsky and Jewish organized crime? Is that a possibility?
It's funny you mentioned that. The first gangs of the revolution, 1905, 06, 07, were mostly guys from Brooklyn that Trotsky had hired. There is no enforcement against Jewish organized crime in America. They have free rein. I think it is a definite possibility.
So back to Stalin and get into World War II and the confrontation. What was the confrontation between Hitler and Stalin? And, of course, first the non-aggression pact followed by the invasion a few years later. Could you kind of inform us about that and what was Operation Barbarossa, if not a scheme for Lebensraum?
Well, that may have been a consideration for some people. I think Hitler was concerned with having this unpredictable empire at his border. Once he took part of Poland, he now bordered the USSR. And once he was convinced that the West, as they always have, supported the Soviet Union against pretty much anybody else, Hitler realized that nationalism was the enemy, not communism. There was no ideology other than nationalism that mattered, no racial group, no ethnic group. So, but that was a part of it. I mean, Germany didn't really need that. They could have had very good trade pacts with a firm Aryan, allied Ukraine that wouldn't have required an invasion. So, no, I mean, I don't think it would make any sense from a military or even a philosophical point of view.
Okay, we're just getting ready for a break, Matthew, but when you get back, I want to touch more on that, more about World War II, and of course, I want to talk about the Cold War years rising up to the point where the fall of the Soviet Union, the rise of Putin, and what we see in the future. Is Putin actually a Jewish lackey or not? But we will discuss that when we come back after the break.
You're not always at your computer, but that doesn't mean you need to stop listening to Renegade Broadcasting. A good way to catch our shows while you're on the go is by finding us on TuneIn Radio. There is an app for your iPhone or Android, TuneIn.com. There are also plenty of other ways to access the 24/7 stream right on the homepage at RenegadeBroadcasting.com. And that first button underneath the player is a direct link to our page on TuneIn Radio. Please remember to follow us and share with your friends.
Aryan Talk. We're with Matthew Johnson, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, and we're getting back with him. Matthew, you there?
I am still here.
Great, great. All right, we were talking about Operation Barbarossa, and we were getting into that aspect of the Russian history. Could we go back into that, possibly?
We go back what?
To the Operation Barbarossa, we were just getting into that part.
Sure. What do you want me to say about it?
I just started to get to the point where Operation Barbarossa happened. We got to the non-aggression pact, right after that, going into World War II, and just take us from the history from that point onward.
All right. So Hitler and Stalin had a non-aggression pact, the so-called Ribbentrop Pact, which was broken allegedly by Hitler in 1941. It was mutually beneficial for both parties. Remember, the Western powers were supporting Stalin in every possible way. The USSR was built. Every brick in their industry came from the West. So he needed to build his forces, though, before he could hit it. Unfortunately, the British did something very nasty, and it caused him a reputation decline among the Slavs, and that was they overthrew Prince Peter in Yugoslavia. It was an Air Force coup, and so Hitler had to make sure that they were pacified first. So he invaded Yugoslavia, installed Prince Paul, and Lojek and everyone else, was a strong NS movement there anyway. And then that's one of the reasons that he invaded when he did. He was delayed there, and that was an English coup, though. But from that, the West helped Russia rebuild. It's true that they weren't a part of the Marshall Plan, but what's not mentioned in the history books is that there was another plan that the West came up with to bail the Russians out. They allegedly, Stalin didn't like the Marshall Plan because it would force them to turn over their financial books, their budget, to westernize, to the banks. That was the alleged reason for Stalin saying no to it. That was okay because they just came up with another plan that bailed them out. Remember, there was regular contact and trade between the West and USSR right up until the very end. Only until you had a national government did you suddenly become anti-Russian. Nationalism is the only enemy. The only time the Soviet Union became a problem in the eyes of the West is when they threatened to create a trading bloc that didn't include the dollar. Otherwise, they were a stable source of money. They never treated Khrushchev or Brezhnev like they do Putin. As of right now, there's a massive military buildup in Scandinavia, in the Baltics, and in Romania. I have a source in Romania talking to me about the huge American buildup in Romania that is very unpopular and must be very expensive. I just don't know why. There's no reason given. Putin hasn't done anything. Russia hasn't done anything. They're a nationalist government that removed the Rothschilds from power, which they were in power in the 1990s, and became an enemy of the West thereby.
So even though that Trump is now the president and so many people were linking him with Putin, that hasn't changed anything with this buildup, even though Trump is still in office, the buildup continues as what the Jews really want to happen in this situation. So you have still a very big buildup of military strength, even with the current administration.
So far. But given his Secretary of Defense, that doesn't surprise me.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of talk, I'm Jewified. Putin, even though you claim that he is anti-Jewish and anti-New World Order, that he's a nationalist and he stands for Slavic and Russian sensibilities and Christian Orthodoxy, there's still many of us who still believe that he is not our white saint. He is not our white nationalist leader. He's not the great white man, but in fact, another pawn of the Jews. What would you say to someone who came to you and said that?
I have a book out on Vladimir Putin's political theory, his ideas on the Jews and Christians. What does this man have to do to convince you that he's on our side? Now, I don't know about being a white saint leader. He doesn't even claim that. But he has purged the money changers from Russia in the 1990s. He kicked them out. He has been supporting Hamas and Hezbollah against Israel and Egypt with cash. And he's backed Assad's regime. Christianity is essentially the state religion of Russia now. What does this man have to do to convince you? I think people are used to being let down so much. I think people are used to frauds and fakers coming out that they can't, when they see the real deal, they don't know what to do. So I would say, I don't know what to tell you. All the evidence that you've seen, if you're still convinced that he's a lackey, then I guess that's what I am, because it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, this is very interesting to note that there's still a buildup in Eastern Europe with troops for Allied troops here, and so this is something too. I did want to ask you this. Why was Putin Man of the Year in Israel in 2015 and banned Holocaust denial and criticism of the Red Army and its symbols in Russia? I mean, that's the only thing I don't understand. If he is in fact so pro-Christian, so anti-Israel, why would he do this? Was it just, does he say something to pacify the Jews so they get off his back, or what is the motivation behind this? For him being Man of the Year in Israel in 2015 and banning the Holocaust denial.
Yeah, I've read the law in the original from the official, the legislative website, and it doesn't say anything like this at all. Essentially, what it says is it makes no. By the way, no one's been persecuted. Prosecuted, I should say, under this law. It's like 2 years old now, and it has, no one's ever been arrested for it. Mm-hmm. So it essentially says that you can't, those disrespecting Russia's role in World War II are liable to jail time. That's essentially what it says.
So it doesn't say anything about Hitler and the Holocaust?
No.
It does not. Okay, and what about what would you say about this Man of the Year in Israel too? Because I'm sure a lot of people who are on the fence here or critical of Putin might bring that up. How do you explain that? Why would Israel, which is just so riddled with their people and their Jewry, so supportive, make him Man of the Year?
Well, that doesn't mean they like him.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Time made Hitler. What year did Time make Hitler Man of the Year?
I think it was 1938.
Yeah, it doesn't mean they like him. It just means that they see him as of immense importance in global affairs.
Ah. Okay. So, there was an incident I see that Holocaust deniers in Russia now face 5 years in prison. Who was that, and did these people actually do jail time for being a Holocaust denier? It seems that there was a release on this on Forward.com.
Oh, I'm sure there was, and yet he made Alexander Solzhenitsyn's work mandatory reading in Russian high schools, even though he denies it too. We have. Holocaust denial is day-to-day talk there in the Duma. It's normal, here it's a big deal, but there it's just day-to-day talk.
This also serves, let's just be a devil's advocate here. You have Putin, supposedly, who is anti-Israel, and you have Trump. Now, Trump, on the other hand, is not anti-Israel by any means. In fact, when they asked him questions about Israel, he says very unfair to Israel. Everyone's being very unfair to Israel. And he's basically touted the Jewish line. Even in his inaugural address, a rabbi spoke directly after him. So he's, you know, Trump isn't anti-Jew. He's very pro-Jewish. His own family has married into Jews. So Trump, in the buildup is still happening, would you say if Putin really is anti-Israel, then we see that Trump, on the other hand, is following what the Jews want and continue to be hostile towards Putin. Would you say that was the case then?
I think it's too early to tell, but his defense minister pick and his continued buildup might suggest that that's the case.
Mm-hmm. So anyhow, we're getting back into Putin and tell me a little bit about his activities as far as the Russian Orthodox, the Eastern Orthodox Russian Church, and exactly what he has done so far. Because he has done a lot, and I agree with this, he's done a lot to promote Christianity, to re-Christianize Russia, and also to promote the birth of white Christian families. Could we talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely, yes. There is a tax relief. I don't remember off the top of my head what the percentages are, but it's similar to Hitler's program for tax relief for having children. This is dealing with the demographic crisis. You had the same problem in Belarus. And now, under Lukashenko, who is certainly one of our people, in almost all respects, and the birth rate is now increasing. And the same thing goes for Russia. The demographic crisis is now over. When he went to Mount Athos last year, he sat in the same stall, the major monastic center that the Byzantine emperors would stand. And he knew what he was doing. And with the violence with Turkey and shooting down the Russian plane, Russia can completely, you know, remake the Middle East, remake world history here. He doesn't see himself as the head of Orthodoxy, but he's been promoted that way. He's made Christian reading a regular day-to-day thing in Russian school system. Now, remember, Putin's not a dictator. You know, he has to work with the Duma, which it's true, the majority of his political party, United Russia, you know, if you want to run against it, you're in big trouble because, you know, you'd be very unpopular. But so, you know, he has to work with different committees and he's not assigning every little assignment. But what we're talking about is, you know, he's made Christian reading, Orthodox reading, the day-to-day life of the Russian people. He was secretly baptized as a boy by his mother. I have an article on this and he has spoken about this in public. So he was a secret Christian throughout the USSR period, his period in the USSR. Remember, if no one took Marxism seriously in the Soviet Union, they only took it seriously in the West. The big problem was between Russian patriotism and Soviet patriotism. And sometimes that gets mixed, and that's true. That does get mixed. But Putin is really the only major leader in the world who is actively promoting the Orthodox Church and its institutions on the local level. And this is why, you know, the Jews exist, to stop that kind of thing.
So now we are in we're in the current situation, the current world situation. What do you think is Putin's next move as far as Israel and Iran and dealing with President Trump at this point?
I tell you something. I didn't predict his intervention in Syria. It was a brilliant move. I couldn't have predicted that in a million years. He can outfox these people all the time. It appears that Assad, thanks to him, has won the war, which means that Turkey has to make a decision as to where it's going to go. Yet again, it seems that the prime minister is leaning towards him. The republics in eastern Ukraine are safe. The Crimea has now tremendous Chinese investment coming in. Same thing for Transnistria. These are prosperous areas now. His next move is going to have to deal with Kiev and the Ukrainian issue. And I think the U.S. is tiring of writing checks to this government. You know, the whole purpose of it is to act as a advance guard against Russia, but that's going to get tiring very soon.
Now, there's a situation right now. What is, you think, is behind the assassination of that Russian ambassador, and what's the story around that?
I haven't looked into it as much as I should have. There's been more than one. I believe there's been three who have been killed under mysterious circumstances recently. If that's the case, then it must be CIA. There's no other option. The CIA is at war with Trump, and so much of what Trump does is going to be dictated by his war with the Central Intelligence Agency. But it hasn't happened recently, and I'm not really sure. Putin hasn't responded. He hasn't made any accusations, so we have to see.
Let's divorce ourselves from Putin for a moment and go into the current situation, the current administration. He has asked, and I saw this on White Resistor, and I don't know, I actually heard that maybe it was just being called off on a few groups like the NSM and other organizations. But is this a fact that Trump has remove the stranglehold on the white nationalist groups and the eye on the white nationalist groups from the FBI at present and called off all the investigations into white nationalist groups? Is this a fact?
Well, if there's an investigation of white nationalist groups without any crime being committed, then it's illegal. I don't know if it's a fact at all. But
you don't think there ever has been a systematic investigation of white nationalist groups, that might be a smokescreen just to pacify the white nationalist groups to keep them afraid of being caught as, you know, with all these different groups and things like that? Do you think that's the case?
No. I think you know, the FBI has been after these groups for a long time. I think CompoPro is still around. I think agent provocateurs are still around. I think they cause tremendous damage. But I've not come across Trump dealing with that particular issue.
So you think that maybe with Trump in the seat of power, that this might improve for us?
I remember saying near the end, just before the election, if Hillary wins, it's going to be open season on us.
I agree.
I should have saved these, but I was foreign polls of American voters from, I went to Indonesia, Pakistan, Russia, a few other places. They had her at 10%. I didn't see a foreign poll of American voters having hit Hillary more than 10%. I mean, we saw her tiny little rallies that she had. She didn't campaign very much. And Democrats didn't like her. They wanted Bernie, at least, or Joe Biden, anyone but her. Her background is too bad. You can't have another Bill Clinton in office. So I think, and my view is that the American election was rigged. The American election was If it were in any other country, the U.S. would call it invalid and put sanctions on that country. And yet, Trump still won. So, yes, you're absolutely right. It would have been open season on us without and their reaction to Trump's victory is something that really is part of the most upsetting thing I have to deal with these days. It's ludicrous. It's insane. It's violent. It's sick. And it needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we just in the NSM, we just had the NSM just had another informant exposed just in this past week. So there's definitely there still is a open season to some extent on white nationalist groups, and you don't see the same dedication going on with the Islamic terrorist groups or even the black groups, which are racially motivated. It seems to be solely against white nationalist groups. Would you agree on this?
I do agree with that. Who was the informant that was exposed?
He was actually a really prominent person in the NSM media. He goes by the name Arian Knight. He was just exposed as being a major informant for the FBI.
Oh, okay. Well, it doesn't surprise me. There's at the University of Kansas, Laird Wilcox has his Museum of Extremist Politics. One of the things that Laird Wilcox does is he traces the FBI's dealings with extreme groups, and he admits openly that it's almost always against white nationalists. Obviously, these anarchists and everything, they're fighting for Hillary. They're fighting for Wall Street. And he's making it very clear that that those riding in the streets, the Antifa groups right now, are working for big money. There will be no investigation on that. But if you want the numbers for that, go to Laird Wilcox. And he also publishes the yearly hate hoax book. For fake hate crimes every year that he does. He's been doing that for decades.
Yeah, there's a lot of fake hate crimes, and they're always attributed to white nationalists. In fact, you know, the Antifa, they're the really the violent ones. You know, these in the Jewish Defense League. I mean, all these groups, the JDL, the Antifa, they're all very violent groups. And how many violent actions do you see white nationalists at rallies? We just sit there peacefully speaking our minds, yet we're the ones who are vilified, and they're the ones who are the great heroes. You know, and you look at these Antifa with their skinny jeans and their little gay looks, and you wonder, what the heck is going on here? You know, it's just like everyone wants to support what is anti-American, anti-white, Aryan, and just go with these freaks. And this seems to be the, you know, people, and when you look at the anger the white nationalists bring forth, you know for a fact that the level of brainwashing in the population is so extreme that the very idea of the swastika or Hitler creates great emotional backlashes. And the question I have for you is, how in the future, if we're going to have a national socialist future, how are we ever going to retake our populace? How are we going to get rid of the brainwashing and the double standards that exist in this society? It's going to be a hell of a try to do.
Well, your premise is absolutely correct. It would never be in the interest of any nationalist to commit a violent act. The system is goading them. It would love for that to happen. And the purpose would be, of course, to paint us all as a terrible, violent, unpredictable people that need to be shut down. Whenever I see a hate crime, especially the Jewish cemeteries, which has turned out to be fake, I just assume it's fake. Because none of our people would be so idiotic to ruin the situation we have now by doing something so meaningless as knocking over gravestones or torching a synagogue. That's ridiculous. But the Jewish Defense League was the number one terrorist organization in America for years on the FBI list. And so, you know, the Antifa groups are extremely violent without provocation. I know of no nationalist that would be like that. It's all self-defense.
Yeah, and not only that, you look at even back in the early 60s with the KKK violence, you know, it's been exposed later on that those KKK elements that were committing violence were actually on the FBI payroll. Isn't this correct?
Yes, in fact, and I have Laird Wilcox to thank for that information. Because, again, Laird Wilcox is a liberal, as far as I know, politically, but he's honest. And he's been promoting the idea that, they liked posing with guns, posing with weapons, and with threatening captions in their pictures and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. He reprinted a lot of those. What interest does that serve? Certainly not ours. It just gives the regime an excuse to destroy them. So you're absolutely right. Yes, the answer is yes.
I mean, when you look at what happened with Dylann Roof, now I would never disavow Dylann Roof in the sense that I believe he was sincere and that he was a loyal person to our cause, but the very act would happen with the killing of those blacks. And again, you know, when you look at the blacks who are killed, we know that black churches are always the center of black nationalist and extremist activity. They're not little innocent little church gatherings like your local white evangelical church. There's often things there that are going on that are detrimental to our people. However, the very act that they got killed was just an excuse to ban the Confederate flag. I mean, it had nothing to do with the Confederate flag.
That's right.
That was the excuse. And that was actually more damaging to our cause than anything that Dylann Roof was fighting. Because, you know, I won't say that the Confederate flag is purely a white nationalist symbol. It's become that. But, you know, even, you know, Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, adopted a black son.
That's right.
And Robert E. Lee was an abolitionist. So there wasn't a strong pro-white sentiment throughout the South. It was a Southern-related issue. It was just Southern nationalism, not white nationalism. And that's where people sometimes mistaken. But at the same time, there were more plantations and more slavery in the North at one time than the South. So the problem is what we're going to do next? Ban the Stars and Stripes as our next move. Because people who formed that, first flew that flag, were slave owners. This is getting to the most ridiculous level,
right?
And the blacks are eating this up. And the more they do it, the more they rile our youngsters up who are on a mission to destroy racism. And they don't even understand what racism is or what it relates to their own race.
Not a clue.
All they think about is this propaganda that's spewed by the Jews, by the blacks, and this whole alien culture.
Usually having
something to do. I don't know what the solution to getting our people back on track. Do you have any ideas?
Oh, sorry, I didn't answer that. I apologize for that. William Pierce said that the overwhelming majority of the American population goes along with what they're told. If we were to take over tomorrow and run the media and the corporations, they'd be singing our tune just as vehemently as they're singing theirs.
Exactly.
So that doesn't bother me very much. Most people are lemmings, as he would say, and he was absolutely right about that. They don't think it's individuals. They don't. It's all virtue signaling, trying to convince the system that they're okay. It's like the young white professor who gets hired at a university is so frightened of being called a racist that he becomes the most violent anti-racist on campus. He's overcompensating. They live in fear. It's absolutely the case. It's true. Thaddeus Stevens, one of the sickest individuals in the 19th century, you know, he fought Abraham Lincoln's plan to ship the slaves to Africa. And Thaddeus Stevens says, no, I need them here. And then he says, I'm going to let them arm them and let them loose on the South, and we'll I think his exact phrase was, I'll let them know what a real race war is. That was right after the Civil War. Thaddeus Stevens, of course, the leader of the radical Reconstructionists in the South. That kind of thing proves that this type doesn't give a damn about, they don't care about black people. They're using them as a reserve army against any revolutionary force. And that includes us.
You see, the blacks don't even realize it. And, you know, they are really a sad case because they're being used by the Jews for their own ends. And the blacks are completely oblivious that they're the real enemy. At least there's some blacks that do realize that. They realize that they're the enemy. But most of these blacks, like Louis Farrakhan, just class the Jews as kind of rich, exclusive whites. And they're not white. They're Asiatic. So the blacks are oblivious not only to the Jewish question, but the Jewish racial question. And the whole ordeal is just, again, put back on whites, as if the Jews are yet another arm of us. And see, that's where they're mistaken.
It's one of the most serious mistakes in American politics. It skews all the figures. It skews the income figures and education figures and everything else. They have to be removed from the white population statistically so as to get proper results. There's a famous high IQ question. The U.S. Census Bureau, if you remove Jews from the white population, whites have the lowest earning potential with the highest IQs. You take the highest IQ earners of the displayers of every race in America, and your elite, your leaders are supposed to be your leaders of your race, and whites with high IQs score by far the lowest. That those whites with high IQs are not doing very well, and I think that's the issue. I think that's what you're pointing to.
Yeah, and why do you think that whites who have an outstanding intellect are in fact scoring the lowest and doing the lowest and being at the lowest level of their productivity potential? Do you think this is primarily due to affirmative action and also the promotion of the low-class, low-income, low-intellectual blacks to higher places in government and jobs and in education?
I think it's very possible. What I'm referring to, I read on David Duke's website about 5 years ago, and that he took Census Bureau reports, the top IQ people in each race and how much they earned, and whites were by far the lowest. So I wanted to clarify that. I think affirmative action has a lot more to do with hiring and firing. I think it has to do with the mentality that you give them a break because they're black. You don't have to, you don't get offended because they're black. You let them go because they're black. It affects everything. That somehow they deserve, they've earned the things that we've created. It's disastrous. And I think the affirmative action is a whole vision. I think it's a whole way of life for most people. That really comes from fear, the belief that if they're called racist, their life is over.
Yeah, and I think we need to maintain a sense of dedication within our ranks, within the ranks of National Socialism and white nationalism, that this is probably par for the course. It's just one of the things that will happen. You will be called a racist, but you need to understand that the word racist doesn't have to imply what they're implying. It actually represents a dedication to our race and a reassertion that we're in the right and they're the wrong. And we shouldn't ever feel compelled to conform to the status quo just because they want it so. And this is the problem that we're facing. I interviewed a guy once who runs a really well-known white nationalist talk show, that he's afraid to death that the FBI are going to come calling at his door. So he says, I'm a journalist. I'm a National Socialist, but I'm not a revolutionary. Damn it. If you're a National Socialist, you are a revolutionary, and you are in revolution for our race. Do you agree?
Yeah, there's really no getting out of that. We read what happened to the order, Robert Matthews and everything else. We see what happened to them. I think if they wanted to, the system could machine gun a bunch of kids on a playground and say it was you. And the media would believe it. You know, how many people are prepared to deal with that? To be a revolutionary would mean to have no home or family, to have no connections, to have no friends, because they could be used as leverage against you. And we don't have that. Now, I have many black friends, especially former students over the years, and they're good people, very good people, but all they see is race. That's the only thing they see in people. It's the first thing they notice. I don't think they mean to do it. It's just a part of the culture. Only whites are told not to see race.
You see, so, and that's the point. The blacks are one of the most racist cultures in existence because everything they do is defined by their race. And it's almost a crime that we as whites can't do the same and not care if other people say it's wrong because this is our race. This is our future. The race is a glorious natural creation that we should love and cherish permanently throughout our lives. Don't you agree?
Yes, of course. Yes. And in the black community, that's a normal day-to-day thing to say. That's not the case for us, though.
Are we a damned species, so to speak?
What?
Are we a damned species? Are we damned for all eternity to die and perish? Or are we going to wake up and realize that we need to fight for this?
You know, of all the civilizations and ethnic groups and cultures that I've studied over the years, the dozens and dozens of works of dealing with different cultures, I've never come across one that hated themselves, that somehow was told that they were all evil and therefore they should go out of existence. I've never come across that. Even at the end of Rome, there were still Roman patriots, regardless of their corruption. I've never come across it. Only Westerners in, our era hate themselves. The white suicide rate, I think, as you probably know, is white male suicide rate is the highest by far amongst all the races, proportionally speaking. White mental illness is the highest among all the races, proportionally speaking. And I think it has to do with this. Being told that you're evil and sick and you shouldn't breed means that we are not going to have large families or have families at all.
Now do you think that this whole idea of whites being low, but of them not being worthy of existing. Do you think that also plays into how we were suckered into so many wars that we had to give of ourselves to other nations because our nation wasn't worth it?
I'm not sure about not World War II. I mean, there still was a racial respect back then. This is the 1940s, remember. Mm-hmm. I think this has really been the last 40 years, maybe. That whites are petrified of any racial connection with themselves. And the self-hatred is everywhere.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I have to say this. Do you think that the first two world wars were just another part, not just to get Israel for the Jews, but yet another part of this white genocide scheme that actually destroyed the white race? I mean, at the beginning of the 20th century, we were some 30% of the population. After the Second World War, most of us, through first the Bolshevik Revolution, then World War One, then finally, first World War One, and then of course the Bolshevik Revolution, and then World War Two, that size was greatly diminished. Do you think that the world wars, and even the wars of today, are just one more plan against white genocide?
at least it had that effect. I mean, that was a bonus for the bankers who profited from them. Your best men go into the army. They have to have perfect vision and be physically healthy. That's your best genetic, you know, cluster. That's the, they're your best, and they're the ones who got slaughtered in the millions and tens of millions in World War One and World War Two. And I'm at a point now where I can't read any more stuff on the trench warfare in World War One because it was so absurd, and they don't even know why they were shooting at each other. Not a clue. But these, you know, millions, and then they would have had children and grandchildren. You know, how do you recover from that? You know, this is why we're in the condition we're in.
And do you think that the reason they touted this line that Hitler was a maniac, that he was out to enslave the world, that was just a way of getting away from the repulsiveness that the First World War had for people, that when they looked at the Second World War, they wanted it to be more of a mission, more of a moral direction for the Americans, as a kind of a fight against tyranny, which would mobilize America, unlike they would do if it was just considered another World War One.
Yeah, just look at the propaganda posters that were put out in D.C. and in London, how they depicted Germans and Italians. The Japanese ones are my favorite, you know, these monsters that they create. Lincoln needed the slavery as – he was against slavery legitimately, but not at the expense of a million Americans. But, you know, that was the moral mission that he had. He knew he could mobilize northern groups that had that interest. But there was no concept at all of German German persecution of anyone at the time the U.S. entered the war, which really was against Japan. That didn't come until much, much later.
Are you aware of the articles that were appearing in the New York Times at the end of World War One that said that there were 6 million Jews killed in Germany? Are you familiar with those?
I am aware of it, and I'm aware of it partially because they said the same thing about the alleged pogroms in Ukraine, in Russia, which never happened. 6 million came up again and again and again. It's ridiculous. Not you know, and so that number, it's sacred to them. It's part of the gematria. But that number has been thrown around for many years prior to World War II.
And the number six is a satanic symbol, correct?
It is, and the number of points in the Star of David, the alleged Star of David.
So it actually has a symbolic significance.
Absolutely. Yeah, not every Jew, you know, was interested in that kind of you're driven by that kind of motive, but it absolutely does.
Let's talk about different. There was. Oh, we have a call here. Hold on 1 second. Hello?
Oh, hey, I've got my phone muted. It's Frank in North Carolina. I was just listening. Unless you had any feedback, yeah.
All right, thank you. We have another caller from Hudsonville, Alabama. Hello.
Yes. I was wondering I've just been doing some reading, and I've been kind of reading on the Sunni and Shia sects of Islam. And come to find out that, you know, the Shia is the ones that we, you know, in Iran and everywhere, the ones that we believe they're fighting against the Jews. Turns out that Shia was originally a Jew who converted to Islam. Mm-hmm. Do you know much about that? Or
no. Do you, Matthew?
I have spent some time trying to find out the differences between Islam and Judaism, and I failed so far.
All right, we have another caller coming in. I think it was hitting on us and then left. Actually, we do have it. Charlotte, North Carolina. Hello.
That's Frank again. Frank in North Carolina. Yeah, I'm just listening.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
All right, Matthew. We were talking about Putin and Trump, and what do you make of this accusation that the election was rigged? We talked a little briefly about that, but let's get more into that. We have another 12, 15 minutes to talk about this. So what do you think about this accusation that you mean? I know there was a mission. There was a Trump's sons had gone to Russia shortly before the election. And I don't want to hype this thing up because I'm not in favor of the accusation, but I'm just curious, what is behind all this?
It's a very bad plight for them to start. The world regime, and by that I'm referring to people who show up at the Bilderberg meetings, your elites in finance and academia and government. Russia and destroying Russia is their overwhelming obsession. That's all they care about. And this is just another way to build up war hysteria. And speaking of which, war hysteria against Russia means hysteria against us. I also want to point out that 2000-2001, I was the only person on the right wing saying that Putin was a good guy. I was attacked by everyone working for Willis Carter with the Barnes Review and Spotlight at the time. And, he was KGB, the Soviet Union. Yeah, this is all, now everyone's singing my tune. I was the only one to show that he was a nationalist. The nationalists would go into the security services or to the army. And rather than, some other field, that's all you could do then. You had to be a member of the party to have any career at all in the Soviet Union. So I was the first one to bring that up, and it's very important. So Russia and Russia and Russia and Russia is the only issue here.
So what do you think about this idea that when you look at it, Trump, he actually had also mentioned in his campaign that he wanted to make America the most powerful military power possible. We know that he had a lot of discussions with the military industry. Don't you think that maybe he's just trying to build up the forces even more out of this and maybe not end up being such a friend of Russia and merely continuing the Jewish plan? Because like I said, he is linked through his family to Jews, and he's been very, very complimentary of Israel lately. What do you think about that?
Well, there was no surprise, Patrick. He was Zionist quite a bit throughout his campaign. He wants Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel. He's going to force this through. But as far as the election is concerned, this is the most ridiculous thing. It's an insult to everyone's intelligence that they're so desperate to find an explanation as to why their girl lost and why their ideology, with all the brainwashing, still failed. And they've come up with that. Of all the things they've come up with, shows there's a level of desperation there. They wanted to create a simple story. There's no evidence. There's never been any evidence. There couldn't be, because a hacker like that, connected with the Russian government, would be able to make his track seem like he was someone. He wouldn't be caught. There's no way that anyone could show that. If they're that good to penetrate the election, then they couldn't be penetrated as a Russian agent. So. There's simply no evidence, but it's a simple thing. Hillary people can say, Trump was elected by Russian force and he's a Russian stooge. And that's a simple way to rally the people against him. Trump,
Kyle Hunt has said, and he's actually, I think he might have some accuracy in this. He said there might be a possibility that it was reverse education, go against Hillary and or say that she's going to win the election and then have everyone vote for Trump. I mean, do you think there's any validity to that type of thinking?
Explain that again.
Well, I think what he said is that they were trying to actually electrify the white nationalist vote to get Trump in, to make it look like Hillary was going to be such a liberal. Well, she was, definitely was going to be that. But in some way, get Trump in because everyone will think he is anti-Jew, but in reality, he is so pro-Jew. Do you think that that's correct?
Well, who's they?
The voters.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, it shows you. It gives us a strong optimism. All of this propaganda over the last 30, 40, 50 years, they still voted for Trump. They were threatened at the polls. They were attacked.
Can I say something?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, it's Frank in North Carolina, and I'm very outspoken about the whole Jewish thing and everything. But I believe in the current political environment, Trump had to play to the Jews. He had to play the Zionist thing, or white people wouldn't have voted for him. The evangelicals, the Catholics, the people, quote-unquote, they would never have voted for Trump. So I'm hoping, and I'm very skeptical of Trump, trust me. And I'm also very skeptical of Putin, by the way. I don't trust him at all. But I do like a lot of things that you see and hear about Putin. I mean, I don't know if it's real or not. I can't judge the intent because I don't know. I can't see inside the man's heart. But I was never convinced that Trump hated the American people like I believe all the other candidates did, or most,
that's right.
At least the Democrats. Yeah. I think most of the candidates that ran for president this past election and most elections hate the American people, or at least laugh at them behind their backs when the doors are closed,
right,
and are willing to put a knife in their backs. And I don't think Trump is that. I could very well be wrong, but I hope I'm not.
They see the American population as a obstacle to their agenda, because they're too stupid, and they need to be controlled and manipulated somehow. Trump came up when I was a kid in New York City real estate. The first time I ever heard of the guy. And my father said, if that man could outsmart the Jews in Manhattan real estate deals, then he's got to be a genius.
That's what I was thinking.
On their own turf.
If anybody could ever do it, if he's crazy like a fox, like I hope he is, but I'm not saying I believe it. But God, I hope. I'm praying because he's our last chance, I think. I hope if anybody could beat the Jews, Trump is the one that could do it.
I'm with you 100%. I'm not sure either. Because remember, when the campaign first started, he went to this, I forget, it was a Jewish association. He said, I don't need your money.
We have another caller,
and it was quite
Alex, in Atlanta, Georgia. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling to talk about Putin for a minute. And I don't know if you guys know, but during the Cold War, the CIA bought titanium for the SR-71 from Russia. And the cover story that they had for it is that they had a front company that was buying the titanium. And it's impossible for the Russians not to know that the customer for the titanium was actually the CIA. So, I mean, as far as the Cold War goes, it's pretty obvious that it was a space conflict, just like the conflict in the Middle East, which is being done for the Greater Israel project and so on.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I agree on that. You're right.
I have an article from on NPR, Radix Journal, saying precisely that. It's not just that. American capitalists were trading with the Soviet Union from the beginning, right up until Gorbachev. Only Putin, all of a sudden, now they want to cut him off. But they were every American company. I mean, Henry Ford had the biggest truck plant in the world in eastern Ukraine in 1936. General Electric built their entire electric grid. A mining company from Alaska took out their coal and gold. Standard Oil controlled the oil wells. There was no Cold War. What kind of war was that? And you're profiting from each other.
Yeah, and I also want to say that there was the...
The show's over. Patrick,
the
show
is over.
So we may go. Hail, hail, Sunna, light up the farthest shore. Hail, hail, Sunna, steer us forevermore.
To you every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern. I deal with topics related to our past, present, and most importantly, our future. The show has a lot to offer. Occult knowledge, insightful interviews, hard-hitting analysis, and essential inspiration. I know we are living in a world filled with darkness, but there is a light at the end of the tunnel. We have the power to take back control of our world and reclaim our destiny. But we're running out of time. We need all hands on deck. Will you do your part? Join the struggle and fight for our freedom.